Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, the Ukraine, and we find someone who's half Crimean who lives here in Bristol. Also, Ed Landers here with how to be secure online. Now, he's a real super techie expert, so he's got some clues as to how you can try and keep your privacy on the internet. And Jason Yannakopoulos looks through Private Eye and at some of this week's news. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. And we start this week with Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Tony.
Now, what do you got first of all this week?
Well, we've got the very sad news that came through on Tuesday about the death of the great trade union leader Bob Crow.
Well, you say great. Obviously, it's very sad that he's died. But how, you know, what was made him different to other, possibly other trade union leaders or other statesmen in the country?
Well, what made him so great was the fact that he really campaigned strongly on supporting his fellow rail workers, and he put a lot of effort in going up against the big wigs such as Mayor of London Boris Johnson and the private train companies to make sure, as he put it well himself on one occasion, to make sure that they could enjoy a decent life just like your major politicians.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was criticised a lot, wasn't he? I heard him on Tuesday morning on the BBC. Chris Mason was criticising, he's the BBC political correspondent on Five Live, was criticising him, actually, saying that he was actually always winding up politicians. Well, I thought that was a bit cheeky, just the day he's died. And also the fact that, as a trade unionist, trade unions are much more democratic than our political parties, and also have 15 times more members than our political parties. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Bob Crow, just to remind you who he was. And this recording was comes from last year, 2013, where Bob Crow was on BBC Question Time one Thursday evening in March 2013, talking about what he thought of political parties generally. And let's have a listen now to the voice of Bob Crow, who sadly died this week.
We need a fairer tax system to tax the wealthier, where the gap between the rich and the poor has never been so wide. And it's about time we have to do it.
Bob Crow, as a trade unionist, looking obviously very closely at what the budget might have and what they might do, what effect do you think what Vince Cable has said?
Well, I think the budget will be exactly what the budget will be for any Tory chancellor, to look after the rich at the excuse of the poor. And the fact is the austerity has been used to roll back all the gains that working people have had since World War II. Attacking the National Health Service, attacking comprehensive education, building social housing, all of them are under attack. And you only got to see the figures this week. For example, we was told that when Thatcher was elected, she was giving council houses back for people to buy so people had the right to their house. 20% now of council houses sold off under Thatcher and they are being run by private landlords. People in the Conservative government, some of them own 40 individual houses, flogging them to people because they've got nowhere else to live. But if you look at the policies of both Labour, Liberal and Tories, not the minute policy, they all support privatisation, they all support keeping the anti-trade union laws in place, and they all support illegal wars around the world. The only way you're going to get growth is by getting working people to have more money in their pockets to start spending more of that money. Instead of talking about tax cuts to the rich, what they should be looking at is raising the minimum wage for those people that are at the bottom end, will naturally spend that money and rejuvenate the economy. But the biggest thing is to get people back to work. We've got 1 million builders on the dole, claiming social security and not paying tax, and we've got a shortage of social housing. Surely it's about time we get the builders back to work, they pay tax, they don't draw social security, and we give them homes for people to live in, but more importantly, you give dignity and respect to builders and other people. Henry Ford, in the Depression, a capitalist, doubled the wage of all Ford workers in America because he understood that if people had more money, they spent more money and the economy grew from one industry to another. The disaster of these policies have been is mass unemployment, lowering of wages. And you only see yesterday that Britain now is one of the worst ranked wages in the world. We've dropped about 14th in the world to compare where we were 7 or 8 years ago.
Bob,
and it's been done on the basis to lower wages and attack working people.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's quite a good summary, I suppose, of his politics there, Jason. That was from it was Bob Crow, who sadly died this week, the General Secretary of the RMT Union. He was originally a union activist in the National Union of Railwaymen, and he saw how what the union was doing to actually protect people's jobs, and decided to actually commit himself more and more to working as part of the trade union movement. Anyway, any more thoughts about Bob? From hearing that, Jason?
Well, I think he's absolutely right in what he says, is that by raising the minimum wage, it will stimulate growth and it will make things better for the country. I think that's a very accurate point made.
One of the things he was saying there as well was talking about the unemployed people in the building trade, saying how by putting them to work, you know, then we would have social housing, and also those people wouldn't be signing on, wouldn't be paying paid benefits, and we'd also be paying tax, contributing
to
society.
Quite right.
Something, and all the points he was making there we don't hear very often. It's going to be a real, I think, a loss to the national debate with Bob Crow not being around, because I don't think there's any other union leader. One other thing I remember him saying was talking about the forces of darkness at the palace. When Paul Burrell was saying, mentioned, I think it was Paul Burrell, the guy who was talking about the dark forces at the palace, and Bob Crow weighed in as well, saying something similar about the royal family, saying it's actually a malign influence on the country. Okay, so any more on Mr. Crow? No? Next subject, tax and Yanukovych. Now, Yanukovych, now I know that name. He was the president. He was the president, and he says he's still the president of this, Ukraine.
This is interesting. This is slightly embarrassing for our top accountants due to the fact that they were effectively bankrolling the regime of Viktor Yanukovych through the limited liability partnerships that we've covered.
Oh, LLPs. Just remind us what they are.
They're corporate vehicles that help sort of corporate backers conceal their identities. That is also major companies and bankers, they can conceal their identities using this.
Isn't it amazing a way that all these little companies can be created just as a way of kind of hiding wealth, hiding identity, hiding money? It's almost like shell companies. So anyway, so what are private eyes saying is going on, and what should we do about it?
Well, what they've literally said is that a lot of these companies, sadly they didn't actually name the companies, but a lot of these companies were using LLPs to fund the Yanukovych regime in the Ukraine. And that has led to the unfolding mayhem in Crimea, as they've put it.
Wow, amazing. I mean, I don't know. I think there's mayhem right across Ukraine, certainly from what I can see looking online. Certainly not by watching our mainstream London media. You're not getting a full picture of what's going on. There seems to be quite a lot of trouble right across Ukraine. Quite how this is going to all pan out is difficult to see. And it seems a lot of the regions in Ukraine, well, we'll be talking about this with Irina later on in this programme, who's half Crimean. I mean, at least her grandparents, one of her parents is from Crimea. What are your thoughts about what's happening in Ukraine, given that we know that London has been helping fund this previous corrupt regime?
I think it's very interesting, because certainly in Kiev, the original rebellion was a Ukrainian rebellion run by Ukrainian people, but also it was supported by a lot of fascist groups, so the people ought to be wary of that before they condemn Russia too severely. On the other hand, Russia is, of course, has effectively almost acted imperiously in invading another country's sovereign territory.
Well, it's amazing that the Yanukovych had actually done a deal, hadn't he, to have elections in May. Basically thought the deal was done, and then when he left Kiev to go to Kharkov, Which is a city east of Kiev, he found that what had happened was armed men, that same night he'd done the deal, got into the parliament in Kiev and took it over. Even though supposedly a peace agreement had been signed, somebody with guns decided, no, we're not having no peace agreement, we're taking over. And it's almost as if the peace agreement was a cover for what was really going to go on, which is a coup. I mean, obviously, if you're going to move into a parliament and take a parliament over with armed people, that's a military coup. Okay, any more on Ukraine?
No, I think we'll leave that for your next one.
So David Cameron and his Chequers list, is that?
Yeah, this is
Chequers is his country home, isn't it? It's funny because on the Yanukovych business, going back to Ukraine for a second, the first thing that happened the weekend that Yanukovych was deposed is that the Ukrainian TV did a look at his country home. I remember looking at that, thinking, well, it's very nice, but it's not quite as swanky as Chequers.
Well, it says here, David Cameron couldn't resist tweeting a photograph of the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh visiting Chequers for lunch last week. It makes strange Dave to be open. He published a list of people who'd visited Chequers, list of guests over the past 2.5 years. But, as Brightvire previously pointed out, he omitted the names of any controversial bankers or newspaper proprietors by getting the Conservative Party to pay the bill rather than the taxpayer, and therefore they weren't included on the list.
Ooh, so all of the crooks and creeps aren't on the list. That makes a mockery of these sort of freedom of information business, doesn't it?
It does.
Oh, how annoying. So I suppose that's the most interesting list. Maybe we're going to have to go and wander into Conservative Central Office, see if we can trick their security system into letting us in, to have a look and find out
the whole list.
To find out
the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Yes, and when we do, we will reveal it exclusively on this show.
Indeed.
And we will find all the most crooked bankers, a great big long list of them, spending their time in Chequers. Next story, the New Zealand flag debate. What's going on there?
This is one I didn't get the photo of, but I got from the internet. New Zealand are planning a debate on their flag, on their national colours. They want to get rid of the current flag and replace it with sort of like the silver fern on the black background.
Oh, right. So, yeah, okay. So the idea is to get rid of the old Union Jack. I mean, this is a trouble, isn't it? With a bad government like we've got at the moment, and we've had probably for the last 30 years or so, what it does, okay, these people may get more power and more money, and they may use it for their own benefit in government, but what it does is it lowers our reputation right around the world. And so I suppose every now and again something like this happens where people say, well, we just don't want to be associated with this British flag anymore.
Indeed. It was current New Zealand Prime Minister John Key said it's a flag for a bygone colonial era, and he wanted a flag that represented the new post-colonial era.
Right, well, that's great news, actually. I mean, it's a shame that Britain has sunk so low in its reputation around the world, what with all these police miscarriages of justice and things like that. But fair play to the New Zealanders for asserting their independence. And actually, if anyone has ever visited New Zealand, as I was lucky to do about 6-7 years ago, it's a gorgeous place. It's almost like being in Britain back in the 1960s, where you go into a telephone box and there are phone directories in the telephone box where you can look people up around New Zealand, like
fantastic.
It used to be here many
fantastic.
Years ago. Now, of course, you've got to pay some crooked service if you want to find out someone's phone number, directory inquiries. Mm. Okay, Amazon and Lush. What's going on there?
There's a court case. I can only say what's actually going on, but Amazon have been sued by Lush for infringement of trademarks. Lush's products are not sold through Amazon. By strong deals with such search engines as Google, Amazon engineered search results to direct customers looking for Lush projects to its own website and to products belonging to competitors of Lush.
Oh, really? So, who did the engineering? Amazon?
Amazon engineered this by striking a deal with search engines such as Google.
Oh, really? Okay, so Amazon are doing deals with Google to make sure that they appear rather than Lush. Well, I mean, I almost feel like I should have a look on Lush and start using them instead of Amazon when I hear things like that.
Well, actually, what Lush is? Lush is a cosmetics company.
Well, I mean, I might need some makeup or eye makeup or a bit of mascara.
Shower gel and shampoo, you know, that sort of thing. It's interesting because when they went to case, they were told that they could only sue sort of like the official Amazon company, which is Amazon EU Sil, which is based in Luxembourg.
Oh, not another tax haven.
Yeah, but and they tried to sue Amazon EU SAAL and Amazon.co.uk. They were told they could only sue the Luxembourg company and not the UK one. Even though, although part of the structure involves Amazon's Luxembourg company, the actual Amazon.co.uk website they're referring to is indeed based in the UK, so that argument is not legitimate, as was pointed out.
Oh, they're trying again to hide behind, oh, we've got about 15 different companies all called Amazon. You are allowed to sue this one, but not that one, and we've got all the money in this one, and so when you do sue us, I'm afraid we'll say, we haven't got any money to pay you. Oh, they're so okay, yes. Okay, Amazon, start paying your taxes and then people will start liking you.
Yeah, quite.
Okay, Jason, see you next week.
Thanks, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, now I'm joined by Irina Bondaruk, and Irina is half Crimean. Hi, Irina, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. Nice to be here today.
Now, you are half Crimean. What does that mean? It's on your mother's side. To what extent, you know, does that kind of go back into your family?
Yeah, well, my mom was born and raised in Crimea. And my grandmother, she was also born in Crimea. And my grand-grandmother, she immigrated to Crimea from Moldova. In a World War One, running away from the war.
Crikey. So, I mean, there's been a lot of... This has been kind of involved in a lot of wars, including, obviously, the Crimean War, even before that. I ought to just say that Margiris is also joining us. That's Irina's son. Is it 14 months old, Irina?
Yes, he is.
Just tell us about Crimea and how it fits into Ukraine, because I know your father was born in Odessa in Ukraine, wasn't he?
Yeah, to Trubunary, not far away from Odessa. Actually, but he was born there on my grandparents' holiday time kind of thing, though.
Okay. Well, anyway, what do you think about what's going on at the moment?
Well, I think it's a big mess going on. That's definite.
I mean, people are saying that in Crimea, the Russians have taken over. They've moved troops into there. But as I understand it, that there was an agreement that they should have troops in Crimea.
Agreement with
Ukraine, with Kiev, that there should be some troops there, and yet it's being described as some kind of invasion. I mean, I just wonder what your thoughts are of someone who's got relatives still in Crimea.
I think Western media wants to represent it as a Russian invasion. Russian media representing it as protecting Russian people in Crimea, which is the majority of people. There aren't really many real Ukrainian people in Crimea. It's more Tatars and Russian people. So what's going on is with all the Maidan revolution and anarchy and mayhem and
Well, this was in Kiev, yeah.
Yeah. I think Crimea just decided to separate, and at last they probably had those plans for autonomy for a long time as well. Because Crimea, differently from other parts of Ukraine, is has quite good economy based on tourism. They do have to pay a lot of tax to Kiev and Ukraine. And historically, Crimea wasn't part of Ukraine. So with the events going on in Kiev, and especially quite pro-nationalist overtaking the Ukrainian government, Crimea decided to separate. And they couldn't do it without some backing up. So they asked Russia to help them, and...
But, I mean, surely it's not everybody in Crimea that's asked Russia. It's just some people. I mean, how do we tell?
It's the government of Crimea, which asked Russia for backing up. But apparently this government of Crimea, Crimean government, is really supported by people as well. And people aren't supporting the new government, new Ukrainian government at all, because they see a lot of threat.
Well, I mean, you know, when we saw people out on the streets in Kiev, I mean, thousands of people, ordinary Ukrainians, came out in the streets, didn't they, back in November, December. So surely there was some sort of feeling against the government in Ukraine.
Well, I think a lot of people were against the old government, and but a lot of people aren't happy with the new government just as well.
That's not what
people wanted.
This often happens, doesn't it? You have a lot of upset with the present government, and yet it's all overturned, and then you get something possibly even worse.
Yeah, we have to remember that it doesn't happen the first time in Ukraine. For the past 20 years since the collapse of USSR, it was really like a lot of mess and anarchy in Ukraine, as it is. A lot of misunderstanding. There was Orange Revolution, if you remember. And apparently it didn't result any salvation to any questions. To be honest, Ukraine even haven't formed the army in 20 years. There is no army with the flying planes or sailing ships or anything, and nothing is going there. It's all ruined.
Yes, I can remember that Orange Revolution. How long ago was that?
I think it was about 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, and it sort of seemed to me that the West then got the majority, and we had, I believe, Yulia Tymoshenko taking over. Aren't we in the situation where it's always going to be very difficult for Ukraine? Because on the one hand, the Russians desperately want Ukraine to be with them, and on the other hand, NATO and the West want Ukraine to be with them. They're kind of caught in a tug of war in a way.
To be honest, I don't think that NATO even like or European Union really wants Ukraine that badly. But this is what triggered the events, as we know. And Russia doesn't want Ukraine either, but they do see that there is like a lot of cultural and historical connections in between. So they see Ukraine as their brothers, as the brother nation. And they feel very connected with them. And then also there were economical agreements, open borders, things like that.
And now, I know in the northeast of Ukraine, there's actually quite a lot of oil and gas. Do you think that that's playing a part in all this? Because I often, you know, when it comes to Afghanistan, Iraq, often a lot of analysts say, well, actually, this is really just about natural resources, energy that the people are after.
Well, actually, having some natural resources did base that the people can, that Crimea, for example, it also have some of the natural resource. So they can separate, because in general, Ukraine is very, very much dependent on Russian gas, and they owe a lot of money to Russia.
But it may be convenient for them to sever their ties and say, well, we're not going to pay that debt. We'd much rather open an account with the EU.
Obviously, Ukrainian debt was just written off many times, and I'm pretty sure that that's what they wanted all the time as well.
Okay. What about your relatives still in Crimea or in Ukraine? Have you been speaking to them over the last couple of months?
I have spoken to my mom, who has spoken to my grandmother, who is residing in Crimea, and my aunt. And they said there wasn't nothing much happening except for a few military ships being on raid, being not far away from the shores. And Alushta is one of maybe 10 biggest cities on the coast of Crimea. Except for that, there was no other.
And what do they think about the whole business? So that, I mean, are they maybe? I mean, because there's three thoughts, aren't there? One is that Crimea should become neutral, stay neutral. Another is saying that they should federate with the Russians, and another saying that they should become part of Ukraine. I mean, where do your family stand?
Well, my family would be for autonomy or autonomy in a federation, I think, because it's older generation, and my grandmother and even my mother, they are kind of Homo sapiens sovieticus. It's people with different mentality.
What does that mean?
With a Soviet mentality kind of thing.
Why is that then?
It's just, as I mentioned, there is not many real Ukrainians, pro-Ukrainian people in Crimea. I mean, people watching Russian television, they speak Russian language, they speak to each other. They read Russian newspapers, read Russian books. And, well, what I was thinking a lot about yesterday, like my personal identity question, because I was born and grew up in Lithuania, but I never was really considered being proper Lithuanian by Lithuanian people over there. So I considered myself being half Ukrainian. And if I would go summertime to Crimea to visit my grandma, everybody there would go, no, you're not Ukrainian, definitely.
When you've been back to Crimea, you have a sort of identity which is partly Ukrainian, or what?
I kind of was considered being half Ukrainian, and now suddenly with all the events I become half Russian. And to be honest, I do not really identify myself nor with Russian side, nor being Ukrainian, nor being... I mean, I speak to my son Lithuanian, but it also doesn't make me Lithuanian. Just like residing in Bristol in Britain doesn't make me British. So who am I? And how come my nationality and my ethnicity can change? Like, influenced by politics?
And what do you think of this new government in Kyiv? I mean, for a lot of people, it's a breath of fresh air. For years, they've been fed up with the corruption. Now we've got a new chance.
It is a new chance, but I think it doesn't really solve corruption problems. I see the prime minister, who didn't take this post, like, offered it for the first few times, and now he is behaving, well, I'm sorry, but real, like a real puppet. So it's a puppet politics. And
okay, who's pulling his strings then?
Other guys from opposition, so somebody else, definitely, because he's just taking decisions on what is it needed for this new plan to work, for their program to work. But to be honest, this program is based on, like, Hitler's and fascists' way of doing things.
You think so? Because, I mean, Ukraine and that whole part of the world was a big, arena in the Second World War. Millions and millions of Russians executed by the Nazis in World War II. I mean, the memory is still big there, you think?
It's new wave. It's new young nationalists, like, pure Ukrainian people who want country to gain back its identity as well. I think it's also about identity, the whole question, because Ukraine was part of USSR, and then after even gaining this independence, it's not really, like, once again, it's the ties with Russia were pretty strong. And for Ukrainian people, it's just the matter of fact, like, oh, how come we are not Europeans? They do not really understand the consequences of becoming part of EU, even. Like, me being in Lithuania, because we, in Lithuania, everything was the same. It gained the independence, and it became part of Europe, and it broke the ties with Russia. Although there are people who just aren't Lithuanian, who were living there for a long time, being moved by the Soviet government in there. And obviously, they felt not very comfortable with this new thing. But it wasn't that bad and that pushy. On the other hand, in Estonia, people get alien passports. They don't get normal passports, like in Lithuania. And in Lithuania, everybody got normal passports. And in Latvia and Estonia, people get alien passports. So they kind of feel like being isolated.
Yeah, so they're, even though they're in the country, they're stateless in a way. So finally, this is the key thing, isn't it? There are accusations about the far right neo Nazis in Kyiv. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, that's what I saw. Really, this is really bad. As much as I am not pro police, for example, but I really feel for those Berkut guys who were just ordered not to do anything, and then they suffered, and now their families are being persecuted, like stuff like that.
Just explain that, can you?
Berkut, the police who was guarding, and people who were involved in kind of guarding government and everything in Maidan, they were ordered by the president not to do anything and not to fight with the protesters, and that's why it got on a bigger and bigger level.
Well, that's while the negotiations were going on, yeah?
Yeah, but even when something was negotiated, in the end, the police was just attacked and persecuted, and their families as well. And I say, as much as I'm not pro-police, in this case, I really feel for them, and I think this is wrong. I mean, there were things going on, like new government members and people who are fighting and fed up with everything. They would be putting old government members and people who are maybe a bit corrupt or didn't. Nobody has the proof of it. Instead of actually, like, judging them, they would just be completely putting them to polls and beating them, publicly insulting. I mean, this is really wild. This is uncivilized. If we are speaking that we want, like, people around the world, they're concerned and they want to have a peaceful resolution, civilized resolution. It's wild things going on. It's like 16th age or something.
And what do your friends think about it all?
Well, my friends, we had quite an argument online with my old friends. A lot of friends did actually agree with my point of view, but some are going that Putin is doing a very bad thing and he puts military in once again. But I think this is what they see from the media. This is how the side which they see from the media. And they're against Putin, and the media side that my friend represented online, it was stop Putin now, and just really pro-Western. And she's thinking that she's basically, my friends are against Russia because they put an equality sign between human rights and Russia. Like, in Russia there is no human rights or something. Which is not exactly true. I mean, I wasn't that pro-Russia myself as well, and I'm like in Lithuania, when it became part of EU, it was a very big thing. But then when I saw what kind of price we had to pay for that...
Is it possible for Ukraine, for Crimea, for Latvia, Lithuania, these little countries to stay neutral, do you think?
I think for little countries, not really, no. There has to be backup of something.
So they're having, to choose sides.
I really don't like USA way of bringing democracy, like with drones and wars. I think if the USA would, or like NATO would get involved in this particular conflict, there would be much more victims by now, and much more of military actions. And once again, it would be, in the end, it could get a fight for resource.
Well, I mean, NATO would say, wouldn't they, that the Russians have got involved in Crimea, but we're not getting involved in Ukraine. We're staying out of it.
Did they say so?
Well, that's what they say. Whether that's true or not, I wonder if you think...
Yeah, and Ukraine doesn't have any kind of backup then. Because the backup from European Union or NATO is absolutely virtual kind of thing. Okay, we back you up. We are on your side, but we're not going to do anything about it.
Well, I think it's possible that they have people in there secretly, whatever, you know.
But it's only because Russia is backing up the other parts of Ukraine, and nobody wants a major war conflict, because Russia, once again, and like, they have proper army. Ukraine doesn't have any kind of army, so they couldn't defend or attack or do anything. Now they have an army of thugs, basically, like, after Maidan, and they're recruiting new people, just putting them, like, threatening them and stuff.
I suppose the obvious thing is that, you know, you haven't really got a democracy in Kiev anymore, because many of the Party of the Region's people, the majority they were, elected in the end of 2012, have been threatened, and they've had to leave.
There never really was a democracy in Ukraine, I would say. I mean, they really tried. They tried hard. But it's more anarchy and mayhem, like, the whole time. It wasn't just... Now it got really fundamental and radical and maximum. But before it was milder, but there was all kind of mess going on in the country anyway. That's why people weren't happy with the governments they were electing. But on the other hand... This is democratic in a way of there was just no choice of anything else. Once again, they had to elect something they were giving, and they were believing those politicians, and the politicians elected, they weren't doing what they promised, because it's just impossible. Ukraine is a vast, massive country with quite bad economy, and they had to agreement with Russia and an open borders, and they could do, they could trade and do business and investments and everything, and kind of being orientated to the east, maybe wasn't that bad, but it did insult a lot of people, just the fact of it. People don't understand the value of all those agreements. It doesn't go to people. People are more interested in, like, nowadays, everyday things like, oh, so we're dependent on Russia. That's bad. That's how they see it, maybe.
Okay, well, a fascinating insight, Irina Bondaruk. And Margaris in the background, I think he probably wants a little bit more of attention now. So we'll move on to something else. But thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony. Bye.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now I'm joined by Ed Lander again, our security correspondent. Yeah, thank you. I have to mention it, Ed. Are you in any relationship to, or is you either son by chance, or grandson of Stephen Lander, the former Director General of MI5?
Not that I know of, no.
Ah, but you couldn't tell me even if you were, could you? Anyhow.
Absolutely.
Bit cheeky, that one. But anyhow, Ed, we're going to look at Vice.com this week, an article, a step-by-step guide to making your online life more private in 2014. There's a picture, a cartoon in Vice, on Vice.com of this guy basically on his computer with a big poster in the side of his room saying Big Brother is watching you. And actually what's happening is there's a whole load of official looking police guys in the room next door looking through his wall through a kind of what looks like Venetian blinds, peering into him, and he's sitting there on the floor sweating, obviously completely gripped with fear that the NSA, GCHQ are watching his every move. Now, this is a bit of a joke, but for a lot of us, we are worried. We have got genuine concerns about privacy, haven't we?
Yeah, I think most people are waking up to the fact that our privacy doesn't really exist anymore in this world where we do operate a lot online and share a lot of information. I mean, obviously, there are police operations where they do set up in a house next to some particular individuals and, you know, drill holes in walls and put cameras through. But, you know, this is a mass surveillance system operated primarily out of GCHQ in Cheltenham.
Now, Big Brother, I mean, this is the obvious thing to discuss here, is George Orwell writing 1984 back after the Second World War, was actually
book.
sending a very, I think, very clear and important warning to the future. I mean, he himself said that this is what the book is about. It's warning people against this kind of abuse of technology.
Yeah, he was a visionary. I think what's quite telling is that he wrote the book, or at least it was published at the very twilight end of his career, almost as if he felt like perhaps he might be ridiculed for coming out with such incredible stories. And he thought, well, I need to at least share these ideas, these fears, with the public. And I guess he felt that was the time to do it. It's turned out to be quite prolific, and I think we were talking about it last week about the fact that we've all got webcams on our laptops now, and to be honest, I guess a lot of smartphones have a front-facing camera as well, so those are the telly screens of today. You know, the you get to see and somebody can watch you if you haven't got adequate security on your laptop and if you're not covering it.
Well, I mean, on laptops or on desktop computers, at least we're fairly used to the idea that we might want a firewall, but that doesn't really seem to happen with mobile phones. I had a little look to see if I could get it was easy to find a firewall app to put on my mobile phone to try and stop someone hacking into my phone through the data connection. It doesn't seem to be there. I mean, I don't know what your thoughts are about firewalls and whether you should try and install one on your phone if it's possible.
I haven't looked into it myself. I think perhaps a long time ago, these operating systems were quite locked down, particularly iOS. But Android, I mean, that's open source as far as I understand it. So everyone's got access to Android. Everyone knows the inner workings of Android. So I'm sure that can be quite easily cracked and hacked, and people, you know, have jailbroken iPhones. I would say that I would be a little bit, I'd find it tricky to search through an app store, particularly one as large as the Android app store, finding something so important such as a mobile firewall app, and you know, you'd have to do some incredibly good research, because what happens if you end up not necessarily downloading just a free one, but you pay for one, and actually it's doing the complete opposite, and it's actually, instead of blocking unwanted communications, it's actually sending all everything you're doing off to somebody, because it's a, you know, it's a honey trap effect.
Yeah, I mean, it's like there's, it doesn't actually necessarily do what it says on the tin. I mean, I've had an experience with the Twitter app over the last week or so where I've had to actually completely uninstall it, because it's been doing all sorts of things to my phone, blocking my access to the internet.
Really?
At least, I mean, I can only say that now, because the phone was, we were next to a mobile tower working fine. All of a sudden it completely cuts out. There's no coverage for the phone. And so I was messing around with the phone, phoning Vodafone for about half an hour or so. Eventually I thought, well, look, you know, Twitter seems to be part of this, because I'd only recently installed it. And as I uninstalled it, took the battery out of the phone, started the phone up again. Ah, it all started working fine. So, I mean, you know, this is the problem, isn't it? When you're installing an app, it doesn't... Yeah. Is there anything to guarantee it's going to say, is it says what it's going to do on the tin?
I don't know of one at the moment, honestly. I mean,
so there isn't any kind of proper service where, I mean, you would think there should be some kind of kite mark service out there somewhere that says this app does what it says it's going to do and nothing more.
That would be nice. I'm sure there are websites out there, probably a little bit buried, but they probably do incredibly good, thorough reviews of apps, and might give them, you know, ratings based on security and privacy.
Before we get completely off the subject of George Orwell 1984, I think we're both quite fans of the of him and his writing.
Absolutely.
And his tradition. There's also Newspeak, isn't there? And he talks in there about the way that language is used for one, something that is, you know, where peace means war, where bad means good, this kind of thing. Is that something that, you know, is that really possible?
Well, it's deeply in practice, isn't it? Is it double speak as well, double think as well? So you're saying one thing even though it means another, and it's all of the lovely PR buzzwords that you hear politicians use and spin. Like the classic one is talking about savings to government budgets as opposed to cuts. Sounds quite reasonable, and you know, when you think about it in that light, you think actually, yeah, we should be prudent. If you use the term cuts, I mean, not only is that an aggressive sounding term in terms of, you know, in terms of cutting
a knife or whatever, that's stabbing or something.
It's an unpleasant imagery, and it just has a negative context. And the word that also winds me up quite a treat is that the Americans roll out frequently, and that's, they talk about freedom, and generally speaking, if you substitute the word freedom for occupation, it actually makes sense.
Operation Enduring Freedom.
Exactly. Operation Endless Freedom.
Yeah.
Unlimited freedom.
Operation We're Going to Be Here Forever.
Operation Endless Profits.
Also, groupthink. That's another one which I think it was quite interesting, because he managed to see that actually what you can do by manipulating language, by manipulating people's perceptions, is to get literally masses of populations thinking the same thing about something. I mean, we've seen this in, I think, a lot of parts of the world, particularly to do with interpretation of things like the 9/11 attacks, where depending on which satellite TV system most people are watching or listening to depends on what they perceive. I mean, this surely that's a bit of groupthink, isn't it?
Yeah, well, absolutely. It really helps with divide and conquer. And something I was discussing with friends online just the other day is that the BBC World Service television news channel is broadcast outside the UK, but not inside the UK, which is quite interesting. So you have you don't get to see. Don't get to see the contrast.
Well,
that's
traditionally BBC World Service was broadcast on shortwave back in maybe decades ago, so not many people in Britain would tune into shortwave to listen to it. But then you see, of course, if you were abroad, you'd get yourself a little shortwave thing to stay in touch with London, and people did. Similar. So that is weird, isn't it? So why is that? Surely if the BBC are paying for it, if we as licence fee payers are paying for it, we should be able to receive it, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I did ask them. I sent them a very polite email saying, why is this? You know, when I'm abroad, I get to watch it, and I think it's pretty good. It's a nice, when it's worldly, as opposed to the domestic BBC News, which seems to be endlessly offering airspace to politicians and talking about the royal family, things that I personally am not interested in. And as opposed to me switching over to say Al Jazeera or RT. I thought it would be nice if you could have a, you know, a British flavour of propaganda instead.
I suppose the Ukraine crisis has been an obvious one, where you're looking at a lot of the domestic news services, the Western news services, saying one thing, whereas the Eastern news services, Al Jazeera being one, I suppose, I mean, actually probably a little bit more in the middle, but certainly the Russia Today, giving very much a pro-Russian point of view. So there you've got it. You know, you've got your groupthink.
Yeah, it's hard work, though, that I used to do it. I used to watch BBC, Al Jazeera and RT and try and find... the middle ground, try and find truth amongst all of the various skews, but it's hard work, and these days it's even filtered onto social media. You know, the those with influence are deeply aware of the power of social media, and they, you know, there are viral vids that I've seen produced that are put out there that are just, you know, way too glossy and shiny to be legitimate. You know, they're genuinely trying to sway public opinion as people move away from the television, you know, sort of one-way media, and they're giving people something that they feel is sincere, and they have to share it with their friends because, you know, these people are suffering and we need to support them, when, like I said, it looks like nothing more than very shiny, well-produced propaganda.
But that's in that social media context, people maybe perceive it differently than if they were to see it on mainstream television, because they're thinking to themselves, well, I'm fed up with the mainstream TV. Yep. They're telling me a load of nonsense, so I'm going to go onto social media. And you see another version of the same nonsense on there as well as everything else. Yeah. Of course, the idea, of course, is we're supposed to be trying to concentrate a little bit on privacy, looking at this Vice article as well. So encrypting your web browsing, simple act of browsing, whether on a computer or a mobile device, opens a whole can of privacy worms. So just literally by searching for something or browsing the internet, how does that actually in some way you know, compromise you?
Well, that's a really good question. You're talking about this in HTTPS secure encryption add-on. I've installed that. I did on that to Firefox just as an experiment. It seems to be working well. But if you use something like Google, you know, everybody's favorite search engine, not only are they harvesting that information, but they are trying to encourage everyone to be signed in so that they can not only just associate it with an IP address, they can associate it with you. So you've got the old YouTube accounts that became Google accounts. Obviously, you've got people with Gmail accounts and Google Plus or whatever it's called, you know, Google Circles or social media. So if you're signed into any one of those services, you are signed into Google. And if you go to Google as a search engine, it's you. So they are mining information. They're creating a profile on you and your browsing habits, your searching habits. And obviously, for them, it's so they can target you with advertising. They can sell you things. But as we know, they're in cahoots with the security services, and they get handed whatever they want. So they will have a profile of you based on your browsing habits. So this article talks about other search engines, doesn't it, that don't farm your data off and harvest it.
Now, is that really possible? Because it doesn't seem like there is that competition out there. Google has got such a... I mean, it's almost like Hoover, isn't it? Mm. You know, people used to call vacuum cleaners Hoovers all the time because it was the number one mark, and that's happened with Google. I mean, almost every time I utter the word, I think I should be saying, or your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google. Mm. In fact, preferably not Google, maybe even, because of their connections. I mean, Matthew Cutts, for example, I was looking at him a few years ago. He's one of the top Google engineers. He was working with the NSA as well, you know, before he came to Google. So you see, it's very close.
It is.
This connection between the intelligence services and the search engines.
Definitely. I think the French, probably based on protectionism and business reasons, they did pass a law where the French television services, probably the state-owned ones, were not allowed to use the phrase Google it. Which, as you say, that's a common parlance. That's just, you know, everyone says Google it now. But they said, no, you're not allowed to say that. You have to just say a search engine, because they wanted to encourage people to perhaps try, a domestic search engine. And I think that article mentions one called DuckDuckGo, which I have used and is a perfectly decent search engine. I'm not quite sure how they get such good search results without harvesting all the data. But it doesn't have all the other integrated features that Google has, and that's why we love Google, because people have got Gmail, you've got Google Maps, you've got Google Cinema. I even got used to typing define space a word into Google to get a dictionary definition, or, you know, and Wikipedia articles pop up in the right hand side. It's so well developed, Google, that it's just...
It's intuitive, isn't it? Yeah, it's almost like it's doing a lot of your thinking for you. I know for me, when I'm typing some search term in and it's predicting what I'm about to say, I find that all a little bit unnerving and irritating. So are there any other search engines you think that, you know, actually come anywhere close? I remember when I first started using Google in the 1990s, it was because it had a cache. If a website was down, you could always pop in and have a look at Google's version of it.
Well, that's something I use a lot, actually, because, you know, articles get taken down when people publish something potentially libelous or controversial. You'll see them pulled down, and you can just access them via Google Cache from the search. Or even if you can't search them, then there is a sneaky way that you can go and go there anyway. And I use that sometimes to dig out and share articles on the internet. I mean, I sadly don't know of many other search engines people use in this country. I think in China there is ones that are pretty popular that aren't Google. I think Yahoo's one of the most obvious alternatives, but I don't suppose they're any better, probably worse for privacy. And I remember, you know, when I was growing up with the internet, using things like Hotbot and Lycos. You know, these are going way back when you would...
Metacrawler, can you remember that?
Yeah, you'd go and use all the different sites, wouldn't you?
AltaVista?
Yeah.
They've been bought up, haven't they?
Yeah,
they've been bought up. That's the competition to Google. Okay, well, we've toured around quite a lot, but I think we're going to be coming back to this again in the future, because there's quite a lot to talk about on privacy, Ed, isn't there? I mean, for example, stop telling tech companies where you are all the time. Also, how to protect your contacts. And there's another section here which is fascinating, called Stepping Up Your Password Game, and start talking to people in real life.
Yeah, we should talk about Tor as well sometime, even though it's quite complicated.
Okay, Tor is a way of hiding who you are, so you can browse anonymously on the internet.
I did read up on it, and I have heard about it before, and it's sadly it's quite tricky to explain what it's doing, but it's, the concept is using a peer-to-peer network, a bit like, you know, file sharing, to anonymize people's internet traffic.
So that really means, essentially, that you can browse anonymously, genuinely, and if anyone tries to find out who it was that was browsing, they just get some kind of Tor browser, and they can't see who it was that was using the Tor browser at the time.
In theory, but I have heard that if the Tor network isn't big enough, then it's pretty easy to sniff around the outside and sort of hook packets going in with packets going out. And
Well, that's for another time. Tor. All right, well, you can swat up on that, and we'll talk about it in the next couple of weeks sometime. Ed Lander, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly podcast for your MP3 player, broadcast on Bristol Community FM at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. bcfmradio.com/dialect from Thursday lunchtime. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and they're on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.